You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Stuart Brotman. I'm a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings in the Center for Technology Innovation, which is part of the Governance Studies Program. It's a pleasure to welcome you here for what I know will be a lively and interesting discussion of a really topical issue, which continues as a topical issue. And certainly, as we have our discussion, we will go from past, present, and future in the area. So hopefully you'll have a pretty complete context by the time you leave. Just a couple of orders of business. We're going to not do sort of the traditional panel. We're going to have a little discussion, and we're going to let you listen in on that discussion. And as part of that, afterwards, we're going to have you participate. So we will have Q&A at the end of our discussion part. We'll try to leave a generous amount of time, given the size and the diversity of the audience today. Because this is being recorded, we have a couple of mics, and we have Brookings people who will essentially have a microphone as we point to who's going to be called on. If you could please give your name and affiliation before you ask a question. Typically, as you know, we like questions so we can have a conversation as opposed to speeches or things that you might want to get off your chest. So we'll try to get as many of those questions in as possible toward the end. So let me spend a few minutes. I wanted to at least frame some of our discussion today with some data, and I thought it would be useful for you to be aware of this data. Some of you already may be aware of it. So let me start with what I call the good news in this area. And before I do that, let me first introduce our guest today here. This is Jacqueline Ruff, and Jacqueline is the Vice President for International Public Policy and Regulatory Affairs at Verizon. In the middle here is David Gross, Ambassador David Gross, who is the co-chair of the Telecommunications Media and Technology Practice at Wiley Rhine, which is a prominent law firm here in Washington. And then Sally Wentworth, who is the Vice President for Global Policy Development at the Internet Society. So please welcome them. So let's start off with what I call some good news in this area of global Internet freedom. And the source here is the Pew Research Center, which many of you may be aware of. It's a very respected organization and turns out continuous amounts of very good data in the field. So the Pew Research Center has asked about censorship on the net, and in particular, state censorship on the net. They surveyed a number of countries, and the leaders in this area, that is, those who believe that the Internet should operate without state censorship, are Venezuela, number one, 93% of the survey respondents said no censorship. No state censorship of the net. Number two, Argentina, 92%. Number three, Spain. You see that we have a lot of Spanish-speaking countries leading the pack here, 91%. The United States is fourth at 91%, and Germany and Canada are at 90%. And this reflects 38 countries that were surveyed by Pew. So they found generally that in 20 countries, at least 80% of those surveyed believe there should be no state censorship of the Internet, and 50% of that universe indicated that it was very important to have no state censorship of the Internet. So I've given you the top rung. Let me at least tell you a little bit about the bottom rung. So at the bottom rung, we have Burkina Faso, which is at 40%. Pakistan is at 50%. Senegal is at 51%. Indonesia is at 53%, along with Uganda and Tanzania. So that gives you a range of countries and how people perceive whether or not the state should be involved in censoring the internet. Let's turn our attention to another universe of data, which is by Freedom House. Again, many of you may be familiar with Freedom House, which is a not-for-profit entity based in New York. It has a variety of foundation funding. It also does have funding from the U.S. State Department. Freedom House has an annual survey, which is called Freedom on the Net. It typically surveys from May to May of each year. So the data I'm going to talk about today is the most recent data, but it really looks back to 2016. So very shortly, probably in the next few weeks, we will see a 2017 Freedom on the Net report released. Unlike the Pew survey, there's a much larger universe that Freedom House utilizes. Their survey is 65 countries, and those 65 countries comprise 88% of the world's internet population. So it's a very large universe that they continue to survey. They do this year after year, and so we actually have some longitudinal data that we can look at. I guess this is where I pivot into the bad news part of it, because what we've seen in these Freedom House surveys is that internet freedom has declined for six consecutive years. And so when we look at the trend line clearly is going down. Let me give you a little focus on some of the data that Freedom House has come up with. Among those 65 countries that I refer to in the survey, 24 have restricted social media and messaging platforms in some way, and 38 out of the 65 have arrested people who were using these social media messaging platforms in a way that the governments disfavored. To be a little more granular, let's talk about specific platform restrictions. So in those 65 countries, eight of them limited Facebook, 12 limited WhatsApp, 7 limited Twitter, 6 limited YouTube, 7 limited Skype, 7 limited Instagram, and perhaps more critically, arrests for, quote, misuse of a platform. 27 out of those 65 countries undertook arrests, 11 for WhatsApp, 27 were for Facebook, 11 for WhatsApp, 9 for Twitter, 12 for YouTube, 3 for Instagram. When we look at that total universe of 65 net, Freedom House found that only 17 were deemed to have real internet freedom, 28 were partly free, and 20 were deemed not to be free at all. In terms of that top rung and bottom rung, the fewest restrictions among those 65 countries were in Estonia and Iceland, followed by Canada, the United States, Germany, Australia, and Japan, and the UK. The bottom rung, what we might refer to as bad actors, China, Syria, Iran, Ethiopia, Uzbekistan, and Cuba. I indicated the trend line is quite dramatic and going down. Overall, 34 of the 65 countries between 2015 and 2016 declined, so that's a majority of the countries declined. And if you needed one data point to leave with, today it's two-thirds of the world's internet users now live under some form of government censorship. So with that little tour of the data universe, I thought it might be interesting to begin our discussion from the perspective of each of you. Does this sort of sound like what you see in the world, have experienced? And maybe you could begin to help fill in some of the data points with perspectives that you've gained from your own knowledge and experience. David.
I was afraid you were going to ask for me to talk first. First of all, it's a pleasure to be with you all. I am very impressed by how many people are in this room. I think the attractiveness of air conditioning is really quite substantial today, so I appreciate everyone being here. The easy thing to say, the facile thing to say is, yes, things are getting worse. They're getting demonstrably worse. Worse being defined as the sorts of things that Freedom House has identified and that all of us see around the world. You know, you see that every day. But what I think the question really is, we don't live in a static world. And by static world, I mean that the world of 2000, the late 90s, 2000, is the same world we live in today. And therefore, sort of the issues, the pressures, the governmental pressures, the societal pressures, are fundamentally different. They're fundamentally different because the internet has become so ubiquitous, because it has become such an important part of the way in which people get information. It's become an incredibly important part of every country's economy, and the way in which governments communicate with its citizens and citizens talk to each other, both domestically and internationally. So I think it's much harder to really understand in terms of, are things getting worse or better, because I think we're living in a very dynamic situation. All you have to do is think back on the past couple of weeks, and you hear Prime Minister May talking about restrictions on the internet because of terrorism and the tragic events that have happened in the UK recently. You heard Chancellor Merkel this past weekend talk similarly about these types of things and the concerns. These are countries that have at their root, their bedrock, a commitment to what we would consider freedom. And yet you hear, quite reasonably and rationally, thoughts about the need to have some sort of restrictions. I think for us to really understand what's going on, we have to understand this much broader context. It's not just bad actors acting badly to protect their governments from those who would seek to bring democracy and freedom to people. Rather, we now live in a much more complicated world in which there are swirling issues. Now, having said that, the fundamental issues remain the same. That is the ability of individuals to speak, in my view, the important limited role of governments to restrict such things. And so as we go through this, it's very easy to fall back, as our friends who often are seeking to restrict, to say, see, everyone agrees there should be restrictions, just reasonable people can disagree. My view is no. There are some spectrum there. But there are things that are clearly done illegitimately, including the cutting off of internet access, which we see a lot of in Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, and elsewhere, versus the ability to have a conversation about what is, in a democratic way, truly democratic way, what is and is not appropriate.
So Sally, tell us a little bit, because you're at the Internet Society, and the Internet Society is really organized in some ways from the bottom up. And so you have Internet Society groups around the world. Might be interesting in terms of what you're hearing and how you interact with those groups with respect to the overall issue of global internet freedom.
Sure, and again, thank you for raising this topic. I think this is an important moment to stop and look at the trend lines. And yes, Freedom House has been telling us that things are getting worse, and I think it's certainly clear from our community, the people that are in our chapters. So for those of you who don't know, we have over 125 chapters in local communities around the world, and we hear from them often when government decrees are passed, states of emergency are proposed, legal action is taken, Turkey, Venezuela, India, you name it. And the question for them, I mean, it's not a question, it is their daily life, it is their livelihood, it is their reality of how do they continue to operate, how do they continue to conduct business, how do they continue to take advantage of the global economy, speak freely when these things are happening literally on their doorsteps. I think for our community, we're doing a look right now with them in terms of what is the future. And I think we see a very clear worry from the community, ranging from the people living in the countries that are maybe at the bottom of the Freedom House list, all the way up to countries that have traditionally, as David said, been listed as fully free. There is a growing concern that governments are becoming more sophisticated in the tools that they can use, more willing to deploy resources. So when you have countries that are not economically developed and yet deploying vast resources to shut down the internet or otherwise surveil or block access, that tells you how threatening this technology can be to them. But also the countries that are grappling with issues around cybersecurity, issues around the very real threats that we face today, terrorism and the like, that the urge or the desire or the pressure to act, the pressure to be seen to be doing something will come at the expense of rights, will come at the expense of freedoms. And so I think there is a general sense in the quote-unquote internet community that we are reaching a crisis moment, and that it's really quite important that the principles that David spoke to not be set aside in the name of some preeminent national security or other strategy. We think these things can go hand in hand, but this is, like I said, this is the daily reality for a lot of the chapters that we work with.
Jackie, I know you travel around the world and you have your antenna up in this area, so maybe you could provide some of your perspective.
Sure. So outside the U.S., what Verizon is doing is providing enterprise services and global connectivity all around the world. So it's examples, for example, of a large company that comes and says, we want to be able to provide our services, be connected as an enterprise in 60 different countries. And then we figure out how we can put that together. All those data bits primarily are going through fiber optic undersea cables around the world, and so we have a lot of capacity there and so on. And we will see in the course of offering those services, are there obstacles, are there barriers to such? And so many of the things that are being described here as barriers to communication and freedom of expression of individuals, we're encountering as barriers to deployment to these global networks, which of course are the platforms for all the different types of communications. And I would agree with David's kind of foundational points that to the extent we're seeing increases in intrusion, and we certainly are, it is because the internet has become so much more important in everybody's lives and economies and so on, and so there is to some extent an effort to figure out how to manage that, that is manifest in more efforts for more governmental control. I don't know if you want to go into some specific examples now.
That'd be great.
Would that be useful? Mm-hmm. So I would say that the thing that's of gravest concern to us as we try to look after or be concerned about the internet being, I always say, stable, secure, and seamless, right, having those attributes. In the UN Organization for Telecommunications, which is the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, there are a number of moves right now, and I would throw out four types of them. One is a drive to create ultimately almost like models or templates for regulating internet services. We often see it as regulating over the tops, right? You mentioned that. Internet of Things is a very active area, one that my company is active in. So inside that organization, you'll find proposals for regulations on those types of services. There is also another effort to support a naming and addressing system called Digital Object Architecture, or DOA, that would be attached to some of the devices or sensors used in the Internet of Things. And for some people, it might become an alternative to the existing domain name system, right? So a different alternative way of identifying, only in this case, rather than that system being controlled voluntarily and through multi-stakeholder organizations, it could be controlled intergovernmentally by the UN organization. I think closely related is the development of standards, more standards for gateways at the borders coming into countries for internet transmission, which will facilitate monitoring, measuring, and so on. And then finally, for this organization that traditionally has been an organization of telecommunications regulators, of interconnection, or charging of rates for international calls, giving parameters for that, it's now moving more and more into privacy and security and what you would call more public policy along those lines. Now, I could talk now or at another point about how we then see concurrently in countries similar types of initiatives that are very specific. So again, you know, our vantage point is a company that's active all around the world trying to provide these services, trying to provide the platform for individual communications, and there just are barriers popping up, you know, regularly to an extent that was not previously.
Jackie, I think it might be interesting just to talk about a couple of examples of individual countries which might mirror some of the larger trends that you're talking about at the International Telecommunication Union.
Sure. These are a couple that have been, let's say, active in the last 6 months or so and kind of highlighted. And one is Indonesia, which, of course, is a very kind of vibrant, large country. And they have been working on the notion of requiring data and facilities to be localized in their country for some time. So that's been 4 or 5 years in different ways. But the new part is to actually look at proposals for legislation for regulating the over-the-tops, like Skype and WhatsApp and so on, and look in this case to have additional requirements for partnering with local business entities, using a national payment gateway system, right? Again, this notion of gateways into the internet there, and using only local IP numbers. Another one, somewhat surprising, is I would say Colombia. Colombia has always been a fairly open country. We have a free trade agreement with them and so on, good working relationships with the US. They too, last year, began a proceeding to look into regulating over the tops, right? So I think that's kind of an example of a country that is doing that because it's just a kind of a logical thing to think about. They've recommended also that the data processing centers used be located in Colombia, and they recently adopted a privacy law that will make it very difficult for the U.S., for data to be transferred between Colombia and the U.S. Again, I believe there's a lot of effort to try to figure out if these policies are indeed right or they should be fine-tuned. And then finally, in China, which is always a topic in these sorts of conversations, a recent cybersecurity law, which is very broad in terms of its scope, both broad and vague in its definitions, and that is probably the worst combination of things. Now, I will say, because I know we're going to be talking about what our own government's role in these things, I was thinking about these three examples, and I thought that it's probably important to say that our own government, including in the first few months of this administration, has been very active in advocating to try to make sure that the worst versions of those do not persist. So that's an important
point. So that's a good segue into maybe revisiting what the United States has done up until recently. We'll obviously turn our attention towards the end to the future and where the Trump administration may be going in this area. But particularly given the background of our group here, I think all of you had served previously in the Bush administration in one capacity or another. Obviously, David was the U.S. coordinator for international communications and information policy at the State Department. So I think a lot of discussion sometimes starts with the Obama administration, given that Hillary Clinton obviously made a very visible and dramatic speech at the museum in 2010, talking about internet freedom as an important foreign policy objective, and obviously there were initiatives afterwards. But I thought maybe we would start off with the Bush administration as the precursor for policies that developed during the Obama administration, and then begin to talk about the Obama administration. So, David, I'm calling on you again.
Sure. No, happy to do it. Where to begin? Well, I won't begin at the beginning of time, but I'll go back a few years. So the origins, I think, of our internet freedom policy for the United States, and you can go back much further than I'm going to, but I think sort of really started to crystallize when the United Nations held a heads of state summit in two phases, called the World Summit on the Information Society, the first phase of which was in 2003 in that bastion of internet freedom called Tunisia. And then it was under a dictator, Ben Ali, at the time, pre-revolution. And then, I'm sorry, that was in 2005, and before that in 2003, it was in Geneva as the first phase. And so that really gave, because this was a heads of state UN summit, which in the UN world is about as big a thing as you can have, it gave the Bush administration early on a reason to have a interagency process that was very, what we now would probably call a multi-stakeholder in terms of having a wide variety of actors, not just governmental actors, in to try to understand better what our fundamental policies were on the issue of internet, what we would now call internet freedom and the like. Much of the negotiations over those two phases, and up the run-up to 2003 in Geneva and the run-up to 2005 in Tunisia, had to do with internet governance-related issues, and in particular, whether or not the U.S. would be able to continue to have what it, most of the rest of the world thought was a unique role in terms of internet governance based on history and technology. But it also really highlighted, and I would say particularly in the run-up to the second phase in Tunisia, the issue of internet freedom, the issue of free flow of information, trans-border flows of information, the ability of people to both speak and to receive information with little or no restrictions by governments and the like. So after we got beat up fairly badly in 2005, but we survived and we held our position very strongly, even though it was a very lonely position, I would say. And I think it's notable to say, because we see these echoes now, it was lonely for a number of reasons, some of which are much broader geopolitical issues, but it also reflects the fact that, you know, the United States, as you all know, is sort of unique in its historic and in constitutional commitment to what we would refer to as the First Amendment, that is the ability to both speak and to listen with little or no government regulation. That's a very unique and one might even argue extreme view. I was very pleased, and Sally was behind me every step of the way on the U.S. delegation, and Jackie was there as well, was to prominently talk about the importance of our views about the First Amendment. But we would recognize that that is a unique perspective. So after the summit in 2005 in Tunisia, Secretary Rice really challenged us in the department to do more. Now, I will say that wasn't just a unilateral challenge, but rather Congress was very much challenging the administration as to what we should be doing, and that was driven largely because of dramatic and significant concerns about what was happening in China. And I say that because I had to go up and testify before Congress a number of times on this very issue. And so government does what government normally does, which they create task force, and we created something called the GIFT, which is the Global Internet Freedom Task Force. That was an internal group within the State Department to try to identify the various parts of the department that were working on this. Often it takes an external event to get us to talk to each other. And this meant that my shop, together with other parts of the State Department who are doing human rights issues, who are doing economic issues more broadly, who were doing security-related issues, were able to coordinate our views. That went on through the rest, very actively, through the rest of the Bush administration. And then I was very pleased that very early on in the during the Obama administration, when Secretary Clinton came in, that she not only picked up this process, but she really put it on steroids. You referred to the speech she gave at the museum very early on in her tenure. She gave a full-throated endorsement to the concept and the importance of internet freedom, made it one of the centerpieces for the early Obama foreign policy, and renamed it the GIFT. Every administration always renames that which came before it, to be the Net Freedom Task Force, and was very active. Congress continued to pour some money into this area as well. Now, having said that, I would say that almost all the way through Secretary Clinton's tenure, she really showed a tremendous and impressive commitment to these issues. I don't think I can fairly say the same of Secretary Kerry, and I don't mean to imply that he intentionally was changing policies. There was no outward indication that there was a change in U.S. policy. But as time goes on, of course, there are different things that come up in the world that we live in that need to be addressed. And although he addressed the issue of internet freedom in one or two speeches, one particularly in Korea, I think it's fair to say that the focus started to become more on security-related issues, cybersecurity-related issues. And I think it's fair to say that in terms of the energy levels, that we saw a very firm start with Secretary Rice, I would say a peak, at least up to now, with Secretary Clinton, and a bit of a falling off with Secretary Kerry in terms of the prominence of these issues. And now we are in it with a new administration. It's still, I think, fair to say early days. We'll see where things go from here.
So before we go to that new administration, obviously we've identified a number of major players in this area. We've identified clearly the United Nations through its constituent agency, the International Telecommunication Union, but also there has been work at the General Assembly of the United Nations, and that has been very visible. I thought it might be useful to at least let you know about something called the Oral Revision, which was done June 27th of 2016, so nearly a year ago at the General Assembly in the Human Rights Council, which basically is the home for many of these issues now. It's viewed through the prism of human rights, although, as we've seen, this area has many other dimensions. It obviously has economic dimensions and commercial dimensions. But in the United Nations, the primary focus has been on human rights. So in that resolution, the United Nations said that it wanted to stress the importance of applying a comprehensive human rights approach when providing and expanding access to the internet, and for the internet to be open, accessible, and nurtured by multi-stakeholder participation. Just briefly, multi-stakeholder is a process that certainly has picked up steam in recent years. The notion is that all of the stakeholders, not just governments, not just NGOs, not just private companies, but all of the stakeholders in a particular policy area, and clearly we've seen this in the transition of ICANN, get together and begin to discuss how to approach the area, how to resolve potential disputes. It's a bottom-up approach as opposed to a top-down approach. And so clearly I think one trend we've seen in the United Nations and elsewhere now is to deal with global internet freedom within the context of the multi-stakeholder approach. The UN General Assembly also affirmed that the same rights that people have offline should be protected online. And so that's been an important, at least, affirmation of the importance of online and certainly bringing online protection in the same context as offline protection. I think probably having gone through this resolution a number of times, there are really three elements in there that are worth highlighting and perhaps help us to understand where the UN might go in this area. First, the UN General Assembly called upon all states to address security concerns, which we've discussed, on the Internet in accordance with their international human rights obligations. And so what we've seen here now is the beginning of a discussion of how you balance security interests with human rights interests. There's been a condemnation, in the words of the General Assembly, unequivocally, of all human rights violations and abuses, obviously including things which are not related to the net, like torture, extrajudicial killings, but as part of that, the fundamental freedom on the Internet has been emphasized as something that needs to be protected. And then there's an additional condemnation, again, unequivocally, of any government action that intentionally prevents or disrupts access to or dissemination of information online in violation of human rights, international human rights. And there's a call on states to refrain from any of these actions and to cease and desist. So all of this is wonderful language. Obviously, the General Assembly comes up with resolutions like this all the time. So now let's try to go beyond the language to see from the UN perspective, can the UN be doing anything in this area effectively other than obviously passing resolutions, having condemnations, and stating good principles of human rights? Sally?
I would just point out, in addition to that resolution, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression released a report not too long ago. And interestingly, his remit may have come out in part from this resolution, but he reports into the Human Rights Council, and he's the Special Rapporteur on Free Expression. But interestingly, David Kaye has taken the free expression through the Internet route, which his predecessors had not necessarily done. Similarly, the Special Rapporteur on the rights to privacy has really gone down the Internet route. Not really surprisingly, but again, this, I think, shows how these issues are now becoming, the Internet-related issues are becoming totally infused into the human rights discussion. I think, it is a challenge. These are lovely words, and the thing that you think about, or at least that my first reaction is, okay, and what are the consequences for, in Ethiopia, they shut down access because it was exam period, and they said they didn't want people cheating on exams. What is the feedback loop, or how do we hold countries accountable? And I think this in some ways goes to a little bit of what Jackie was saying, and I believe Brookings has done some work in this area as well, is to try to document the economic consequences of shutdowns, right? What are the impacts to an economy for taking these kinds of actions? These ministers get up in ITU meetings and talk about being part of the global digital economy in one breath, and in the other breath, we see at home things being done that prove the opposite. And I think, actions like what Jackie was describing in the ITU, we see these elsewhere, especially now. I think these kinds of things are moving into the security realm. So there's a group of experts on security. What are the implications of what they're talking about in terms of free expression, in terms of rights? These kinds of regulatory approaches, while they certainly have commercial implications, I think the thing that people aren't talking about as much is what does that mean for the free flow of information when you start shutting down access to Google, access to WhatsApp, access to these quote-unquote over-the-top services. So it would be nice to say that the UN could play a leadership role when we have the nice words like that. But I think we have to see it more clearly. And I think, by and large, it's a very, very challenging place for internet freedom in the U.S.
And what about the role of NGOs in this area?
Well, you know, in the ITU, for example, it's rather difficult for an NGO to have a seat at the table. This is an organization that's member states plus sector members, so paying sector members into the ITU. And so I think, you know, that's a real challenge, I think, if the ITU is going to have discussions around internet policy, which is where the trend line seems to be going. It is very difficult for an NGO to be part of that conversation.
So, Jackie, let's loop back into the commercial world, which is writ large, let's call it the global business community. How can the global business community be at the table and influential in shaping, particularly because some of these issues are not issues directly related to human rights, but basically are related to economic growth and prosperity?
I think the key here is the multi-stakeholder idea that you were discussing earlier, right? And that, as you said, has become the model for many as to how to think about internet governance, and namely that it does have to be participatory and inclusive and not just intergovernmental. So it's usually thought of that there would be governments active, of course. There would be NGOs, civil society, academics, but also businesses together exchanging views on ideas and upholding certain values. And you'll hear in these discussions a sort of a tug-of-war between the term multi-stakeholder and multilateral, and then some, usually governments, will say, well, it's multi-stakeholder, multilateral, but multilateral is usually the term for intergovernmental. There has been this Internet Governance Forum that, David, you mentioned earlier was set up. It did have to have its mandate renewed 10 years later, so that was in 2015, if I'm getting my...
Yes.
And that took place at the UN, because it is ultimately under a UN umbrella. I think a lot of these ideas were tested there, right? How much of a commitment was there to that organization, to that idea, and is it a model where there's a certain amount of sort of meaningful input and even participation in decision-making by all of these stakeholders, or is it just a sort of a consultative source of input? And a tug-of-war of that. But I will say that the Internet Governance Forum was renewed for another 10 years, and so that was encouraging. Business has been very active in participating there, including as individual companies and through a number of different industry associations. So the International Chamber of Commerce is very active, the U.S. Council on International Business, here, based in Washington, and with some leadership from Ambassador Gross, we have a coalition of industries called the Internet Governance Coalition, Verizon, and 12 others. So the idea has been to really try to engage in that way, to try to shape the conversation and just put out models that are an alternative to what I described as sort of coming through the ITU.
Well, I think we've set the table pretty well for the penultimate question, which obviously is the title of our talk today, or our discussion, which is what's next for global internet freedom in the Trump administration. And so this will give us a little opportunity to be prognosticators of what may come. Obviously, we are early into a new administration. Obviously, we have a change of party leadership, a change of political philosophy, so there are many different elements that are at play here. And so I thought it'd be useful to have each of you maybe reflect a little bit on where you see this obviously very important area of global internet freedom going with respect to the Trump administration. Jackie, yes.
Well, I would say that what we're seeing, and what I hope will continue, is actually certainly at the working levels, a continuation of what we have seen in other administrations in some important ways. And I say at working levels just because we don't have political appointees, for example, David's old position or other positions at the State Department and so on. What is important to continue, among many other things, is the work related to seamless data flows, seamless internet, and so on, as well as the overall kind of high-level policy support for freedom of expression. So freedom of expression and seamless data flows, which are very closely related. I do think that ultimately it will be important to have some high-level articulation of that, and that each administration has found a different way to do that, whether presidential, secretary of state, other high-level positions. So that, no doubt, will happen. I'm actually fairly optimistic about all of these things. And I do think that silence at senior levels would be read as a signal, and therefore it's important to do it for no other reason. But we've already seen some examples of good work, so I'll just throw those out. For example, one was at the Commerce Department early in the administration, published a green paper on Internet of Things that was very clear in recapping the U.S. policy for very light touch, a non-intrusive role for government there. And that, many countries are looking at that exact topic. So that's why that is, you know, I go on speaking in other places and I say, look at what our Department of Commerce recently said about the need for flexibility there. Similarly, USTR did its annual report on barriers to trade, and there was good, robust language and statements on the kinds of barriers that I described earlier to the data flow, so I thought that was very important. And I will just stop for a moment and say, speaking of statistics, that in the services sector, we have a significant trade surplus, right? So in the discussions about what type of trade is good for the U.S., we have a very strong positive story to tell there. Speaking of trade, it is expected, and steps have been taken to initiate an update of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and we are hopeful that there will be strong provisions on cross-border data flows there, as there were in other agreements. And I think the government, our own government, is continuing to work in the privacy area to support reasonable and interoperable privacy regimes, whether it's with Europe, we hear about a lot, but equally important in kind of liaison and exchange with the Asia-Pacific regime. So I hope that there will also be, as my final point, continued strong support of the OECD, because that has been a place, again, in various administrations to have guidance coming from, in this case, an intergovernmental organization with advice coming from other stakeholders, but it is intergovernmental and often forward-looking, and they're doing a lot of work around digital trade. So to me, it would be very important for the U.S. government to continue robust support of that. Being intergovernmental, that perhaps carries more weight with other intergovernmental, informal or formal entities.
So Sally, from both the Internet Society and the larger world of NGOs, how do you view where the Trump administration might be going in this area?
Just first looking back, you know, David took us back to the days of WSIS. I think it's important to say that, you know, the United States has had a strong leadership role with respect to the Internet, whether from a technology perspective, an innovation entrepreneurship perspective, or a freedom perspective. And this dates back to the 90s through the formal statements that began really in the Bush administration into Obama. And around the world, people have come to expect that the United States will lead on these issues. So when you are in an intergovernmental setting, when you are in a bilateral setting, or whether it's trade, regardless of the issue, the United States is known and expected to lead on issues related to internet freedom. It has been core to the United States government's internet positioning for decades now, right? So I think what we would hope and what we would expect is that that leadership will continue. The world is looking to the United States. We have, as Jackie points out, we are a leader. The United States is a leader in technology. And its moral leadership is crucial on these issues. And I wouldn't underestimate the small NGOs, the people in our community depend on strong voices on their behalf in the international community. So I think there's going to be a lot of challenges to internet issues. We're already seeing them, even from some of our own allies, as Ambassador Gross pointed out. The immediate reactions to incidents is, what can we do to put restrictions around the internet? So the U.S. is going to face a lot of these kinds of challenges. And I think our strong hope is that there will be a strong statement coming from the Trump administration on these issues, from the leadership, and that the very good work that people at the State Department, the Commerce Department, Trade Administration will continue to do to buttress these issues, it really must continue.
And David, I know you continue to travel the world and represent coalitions and others in international fora and negotiations. So from the perspective of what you're hearing in terms of the Trump administration's potential approach in this area, what sort of input and feedback are you getting in these fora?
Well, let me start by reemphasizing what Sally was just saying, and also, of course, what Jackie was. And go back, I want to make sure that it doesn't that my earlier comments about starting with the GIF program under Secretary Rice, I mean, you can go back, as Sally's intimated, back to the Clinton administration, and Vice President Gore gave a seminal address at the ITU. It was less about internet freedom the way we think about it today, but rather on the even more basic bedrock of having the world get on the internet train. And the importance of having access. I mean, all of the discussions we're having about this really are predicated on having as universal an access to the internet as possible. So we start with that, and I would also give tremendous credit in this area to then FCC Chairman Bill Kennard, mm-hmm. During the second half of the Clinton administration, who really spoke very forcefully both domestically and internationally on these issues. I say that not just to make sure that you all have sort of a slightly more complete view, but it also, I think, really underscores how deep the bipartisan commitment to these issues are. And we live in an extraordinarily partisan time, both here in the United States and I would say most places around the world. But I look forward, and I think I have reason to be optimistic that there is always a reason to find areas for which there can be bipartisan agreement. And I have a strong sense that this can be one of them and will be one of them. Now, having said that, I'm also a realist, as you have to be when you do international work. And I'm a realist in the sense that, as we talked about a little bit earlier, the pressures are different today than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, both domestically and internationally. And we have to be cognizant of that and understand how that works. Jackie pointed out there are trade issues, there are trade pressures today that we didn't see before. In fact, as Jackie's pointed out, in things like NAFTA, we didn't even think about having a digital part of these very important trade agendas. Today we have that close at mind, and we see that as an opportunity to express things like aspects of internet freedom, which includes economic freedom and the like. Obviously, cybersecurity is extraordinarily sensitive, difficult, but every government is grappling with that. Every society is trying to understand that. Privacy is another piece. All of these things put pressure on governments to to regulate in ways that, frankly, were not didn't have the same pressure a few years ago. So we have to be realistic about that. I have every reason to think that despite President Trump's focus on things like fake news, which suggests that there's great concern about the way in which the Internet is used in terms of political speech, that when push comes to shove, when the positions are really being taken by this administration, that they will respond to what I suspect will be, and I certainly hope will be, a strong and clear set of messages from the civil society, from the private sector, from those of who are across the political spectrum, feel strongly about the First Amendment and the genius of the First Amendment, not just for the United States, but as a organizing principle for global interaction. And I have reason to believe that not only will this be where the Trump administration ultimately ends up, but also I have some leading indicators to think that, it will be. We've talked about the fact that there's very little political leadership that has been named so far in our specialized area. One who just had his confirmation hearing just this past week is David Reddle, of someone who's well known to many of you in the room and to the three of us, four of us as well. And I, without speaking for David, which would be wrong for so many reasons, particularly since his confirmation is still pending, I have every reason to think that David, as Congress generally, is committed to what we would refer to as Internet freedom.
David has been nominated to be the administrator of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration
in the Department of Commerce. And, which is the president's chief advisor by statute, the president's chief advisor on telecommunications issue, and plays a very prominent role in the interagency process and on his own, on behalf of that important part of the U.S. government. So I suspect that when the history of this time is written, that we will be once again continuing down the same path with some mid-course corrections, as is always to be expected, but to be committed to Internet freedom in a more traditional sense.
Well, it's always good to close this part of a discussion with a little bit of optimism. I reflect a little bit on Secretary Clinton's speech at the museum in January of 2010, and I think the first words of the speech are as timely today as they were back then, and those words are, "This is a very important speech on a very important subject." So with that, the floor will be open. As I indicated, there are microphones, and if you'll just wait for the microphone to get to you and raise your hand, and please identify yourself by name and affiliation. Okay, this gentleman right here. So the question, I think, is basically putting this in a more domestic context with respect to the current FCC and some of its domestic initiatives. Where does that fit into the global Internet freedom framework, or does it, or are these primarily domestic issues which will be organized and essentially passed through domestic policy? Obviously, one of the things you're referring to is called the Open Internet Initiative Order, which is commonly known as net neutrality. But as you also suggested here, and as we've talked about, a lot of global internet freedom has really focused on content. And so the question, I think, is can, and certainly as Jackie and others have indicated, we have issues related to economic possibilities. So I think what you're suggesting here is, are there other dimensions beyond human rights, beyond trade and the economy, that might factor into this overall equation? Anyone want to venture that?
They're looking at me. That's really a bad sign. Sure, I'll make a couple of comments. First, let me make the overarching and perhaps obvious comment, which is, you're right, Internet freedom is really all about what happens domestically. We're not talking about an international regime. To the extent we're talking about international traffic, Internet internationally, it's obviously involving at least two sovereign nations, if not many more. The Chinese have long now, and has gotten very prominently, talked about Internet sovereignty, as an organizing principle internationally as well as for themselves domestically, and one that's gotten a lot of currency, I would say. As I mentioned before, the internet freedom is only interesting to people who have access to the internet. And so reasonable people can disagree about what the principles are to get internet access available to as broad a part of the world as possible. We have well over 3 billion people now with access to the internet. We have over 5 billion unique users who have wireless subscriptions, the majority of which have internet access now, and obviously smartphones are the key in much of the world. So I think these issues are intertwined. That is, the countries trying to figure out how to get internet to their people as broadly as is extraordinarily important, not just for internet freedom reasons, but for economic reasons, for educational reasons, and the like. But also, I think, touching a little bit on what you're saying, Sally pointed out the statements made by David Kay in a recent survey. And fortunately for me, he's actually he summarized his report into five things. I love it when people do that for me, so I don't have to read the whole report. The five are, because one of which goes to the point you're talking about, network shutdowns devastate individuals and their communities and are spreading, which is Stuart's point. Surveillance is more secretive and invasive than ever. States must back up their commitments with action, which is part that Jackie was talking about a moment ago. Here, in answer to your question, companies are on the front line of the fight for users' rights. And then the fifth, just to be complete, is transparency needed across the board. I have never, ever been in an international meeting where people argued against transparency.
Just to put a footnote on what David just said, there has been research which shows that there's a correlation between internet access and people's attitudes towards how much freedom they should have on the net. And so we see, and that's a positive correlation. In other words, as more people have access, more people want to have a more free internet in terms of what they're able to send and receive. And so part of an internet freedom agenda might also be promoting more internet access. There was a question here, if you could just wait for the microphone. I think it's working now.
I'm Mike Nelson with Cloudflare, web security firm, but I spent two decades working in the Congress and the White House and at IBM trying to influence and shape policy. So I've learned that having good policy is only half of it. You have to have a bureaucratic structure that helps you push that policy, particularly when you're pushing policy overseas. The Trump administration is making a lot of statements about reorganizing, particularly at the State Department. So my question, particularly for David and Sally, is twofold. One, at State Department, you've already mentioned three different offices that involve these issues and sometimes pull in different directions. At the White House, we have OSTP, NEC, NSC, and they pull in different directions. Any recommendations for the reorganizers in the new administration?
All right. So I have recommended to the White House on that very issue that this issue is extraordinarily important. And I will say, both from my conversation in the department and the White House, I've gotten no pushback. I think there's a clear recognition, at least amongst the people that I talk to, that these issues are of great importance. Geopolitically, they're important. Economically, they're important. They're important across the board. We'll have to see. Obviously, there's going to be apparently a substantial reorganization. My personal view is that the sooner the better. There is a great concern that I have that this is going to take much longer than the secretary thought it might take. He's new to government. The window for getting these things done may be much shorter than he originally thought. He testified yesterday on the budget yesterday. There was some questioning about these types of things there. I think that at the end of the day, that these issues will play a prominent role. And in fact, If I were a betting man, and I've been known to do that on occasion, I would say that when the dust settles, that these issues will be viewed organizationally as more prominent than they have been in the past.
Okay,
Jack, is that right?
question up here. Microphone.
Thank you. Thanks. Jean-François Boitin with The Globalist. I have two questions. First one is, the president has shown great sympathy and support for champions of democracy like the president of the Philippines, of Turkey, of Egypt. So what is the credibility of the U.S. about internet freedom after these declarations? And number two, I think you are in a very principled position on freedom on the internet, given the fact that social media are currently used as propaganda tools for terrorists, that over-the-top applications are used for tools in the middle of committing terrorist acts and attacks, and I can give you some pretty gory information about that. How long do you think you can hold on to that position? Thanks to the internet, I can read you the statement yesterday. After Mrs. May met Mr. Macron, the UK and France will launch a joint campaign to push internet companies, Facebook and Google, to restrict access to terrorist organizations.
Yeah, I read that with great interest.
So I think you rightly raise one of the really challenging issues. I would say, I'm not the voice to defend the social media companies, but I think it is the case today that you see companies like Google or Facebook taking a much more active role in this conversation about speech, about appropriate speech on their platforms, and taking more responsibility in understanding the role that their platforms are playing in society. I would say 3, 4, 5 years ago, we might not have seen the same kinds of statements coming out of these companies that we see today. And so I think that that's appropriate and helpful. I think we also have to be careful that, when there was a good piece just recently talking about the tendency, we look to companies, we look to somebody to do this regulation to fix it, to just push a button and make the things go away and take it down. And what we've seen is that the content shifts, people shift platforms, this is known. So it's not a panacea. I think we have to be careful that we don't put all of the solutions onto we're going to restrict the internet and that will then address the terrorism issue. And I feel like we have to be more holistic in the responses. But I think you're quite right. This issue of using the internet for ill is a reality that we as a society have to deal with. And I don't think we have to deal with it, though, in ways that necessarily must compromise freedom, human rights, the things that we as a society have embraced for generations now.
I saw some hands. There's one right there in the middle.
Hi. Thank you. My name is Garrett Hink, and I'm with VeriSign. So in multilateral governance organizations like the ITU, most matters are run by majority vote. And recently we've seen that many developing countries have supported authoritarian regimes like China and Russia. How can countries that support internet freedom win allies and support from developing countries in these types of organizations?
I was going to say that's a jump ball, but I think Jackie wants to take it.
Well, there's no easy answer, of course. I don't want to be sort of blasé about it. But I will say that I think all participants in the multi-stakeholder community have ways of trying to build bridges and find allies and work with people from developing countries, right? And so whether you're a business and you're active with other businesses, we work a lot with mobile operators from all around the world. We work on projects to try to help connect the world more, to try to deal with the particular needs that may differ in a country that has low connectivity, has even graver problems with rural communities and so on. Similarly, our government, I think, just methodically tries to work in really substantive ways and with exchanges. There's something called the U.S. Telecom Training Institute that does capacity building with participants, particularly from Africa and other developing countries. And it's just, every step counts. It's very important to do that sort of thing and sort of meet people where they are, try to figure out how to deal with their concerns in a meaningful way. And I think ISOC does enormously good work in that area.
Thanks, Jackie. I just to jump in on that, there's certainly the challenge of the numbers in any multilateral environment. But I think for us, our goal in the Internet Society, shameless plug, it's our 25th anniversary this year. But that is important because the foundation of ISOC, the people that created the Internet Society, firmly believe that the power of the Internet was strongest the more people that were connected to it. And so that has been our chief mission. And to Jackie's point, it really, when you go into a country, a lot of our folks were just in Nairobi for the African Internet Summit. And those conversations there are about the future. They are about connectivity. They are about entrepreneurship. They're about opportunity. Those conversations are not about, regulating this or that. They are governments and others sitting at the table saying, what do we have to do to get connectivity out to these rural areas? What do we have to do to bring, the power of the Internet and the opportunities it brings to our people? So I think it's important, as David said, you always have to have a dose of realism in any of these conversations. So I don't want to sound too, I don't want to be the Pollyanna here. But on the other hand, it is remarkable the countries that sometimes say things in multilateral settings and you just go, oh, really, don't do that, have, very progressive people in their governments trying to move things forward and trying to grow connectivity in places that might surprise you. And building on those relationships over time can translate into a more productive conversation when you get into the multilateral environment. What rarely works is just showing up and, with talking points in hand. The relationships, the work on the ground, the credibility of the Internet itself is very strong.
Let me just also just quickly follow up. When you talked about majority rules, a few years ago that would have been not a correct statement. Mm-hmm. It would have been that the ITU and many other organizations, international multilateral organization, would seek to do things by consensus. That really broke down, one could argue, where, but certainly at the WICET, which was an international treaty negotiations in 2012, it clearly broke down, with 55 countries not signing a treaty, and I think it was 89 who did. The reason I raise that is Brazil, which was one of the 89 who did and was unhappy with the rest of us who didn't do that, recently just submitted to the ITU Council, which is the sort of board of governors of the ITU, between plenipotentiaries, and said that we should not hold another WICET, another international treaty discussion, unless there was assurance that you could reach a successful goal of virtually everybody agreeing. Hmm. So it is perhaps, I don't want to put too much emphasis, but it may be a reemergence of the concept of consensus over voting. And then just to support with what Sally was saying, in my experience on a lot of these things, ultimately what happens is that domestic pressures, the types of things that Sally sees at the Internet Society in their local chapters, what Jackie sees when she goes abroad for pressuring for responsive regulations domestically to encourage foreign direct investment, the types of things that bring jobs and economic prosperity to countries, ultimately, I think in the long run, has a much bigger impact than the other types of issues.
So we have two questions here, so we'll have you first, and then you can pass the microphone.
Hi, Aaron Rosenbaum, AT&T. How does the proliferating lack of internet freedom in some countries lead to the effect on end users and governments in countries that do have internet freedom?
And so your question is the relationship between those two countries.
Yes.
It's the old network effects.
Right.
You know, the key to, I think we've all mentioned this at one point or another, you know, internet freedom is not just the freedom to speak, it's the freedom to hear. And so it's the proverbial two-way street. And so your ability to be effective as a speaker from an internet freedom-loving country is limited by those with whom you can speak.
I would also say, just from a internet society, sometimes sits in the technical community, and the technical tools to actually implement these shutdowns or censorship or whatever are rather imperfect. And because the networks are interconnected, we often see spillover effects where what was perhaps intended to be a targeted action to take some content down for a particular group of people in a particular geography is in fact much broader than the intent. I mean, the classic one that people speak about often is YouTube in Pakistan. There was a video that the government was unhappy with. They did not want Pakistani users to see it. Unfortunately, the way they went about it actually redirected YouTube for the globe for some period of time. So it was these tools, these instruments that governments or others try to use are imperfect. And so from a technical perspective, it can have implications for people who live in perhaps freer environments.
Can I just make a very brief comment on that? I think there's another way to look at this sort of comparative question, and there has been data put together to show, for example, that with data flows, you have increases in GDP, and that conversely, where there are restrictions, there's been quantification by a sort of a think tank in Brussels to show that there are what to measure the decreases in GDP and the decreases in investment, right? By looking at some of the countries where restrictions were introduced. So, and similarly, on some things like a wave of regulation of Internet of Things, some of that is already dates back 3 years and was abandoned with further thought. Okay, began with ideas of broader regulations than what ultimately were put in place. So there are some sort of success stories that can be used in those types of comparisons.
Great. Hey, I'm Bristow Richards from Freedom House. Thanks for the publication shout out. I want to kind of speak to that last idea that you mentioned, Ms. Ruff, about governments trying to localize their data and limit data flows, because governments with like limited and developing network and data infrastructures can have a valid interest in wanting to limit data flows in order to develop, you know, further develop databases and processing centers domestically. Where can you strike a balance between governments wanting to have to somewhat limit or entirely limit data flows to develop their own domestic resources and human rights and business interests? Thank you.
Should I make a couple quick comments on that?
Sure.
Actually, I mean, yes, that's often a rationale is, oh, this is going to keep jobs here. Somehow it's going to be beneficial economically. But data centers actually don't employ very many people. So, in fact, it's just, a drop, a very small amount in that case. And there are, again, there's another sort of an argument, which is that increasingly with cloud services and with the ability to manage services remotely, you're going to get economic benefits in your country if that data can flow for those reasons. So I think you can put together a number of good sort of technical and economic arguments around those points. Yeah.
Yes, right here.
Hi, I'm Ayana Alexander with Bloomberg BNA. I wanted to ask about the internet transition plan. I believe back in October, Lawrence, excuse me, the NTA chief, he was saying that the plan couldn't be reversed. But there are some people out there who believe that if Trump really wants it reversed, that it could be. What are your stances on that? And if it should be, or if it can be reversed, how do you think the administration should go about getting that done?
Okay, does everyone know what we're talking about here? So as I alluded to before, there is a transition from the U.S. government, which oversaw our relationship with ICANN, which is a not-for-profit organization that manages the domain name system for the internet. That handoff was made based on a large strategic and tactical study that was done by ICANN to essentially have that process move away from U.S. government oversight to a multi-stakeholder process, which created essentially a mechanism for internet now to be a self-governing organization. That was resisted in the fall by certain members of Congress, principally Senator Ted Cruz, and ultimately that transition was allowed to be completed and has been completed to date. So I think your question is there a likelihood, given what I've just said, that any of that could be reversed under the Trump administration?
So I'll fight first, I suppose. I would say first, the Internet Society was a strong supporter of the IANA transition. We believe that over 18 months of work by a global multi-stakeholder community created a transition plan that was good for the Internet. That we looked at it, I should say, from a technical point of view, would the internet remain, and these core functions of the internet remain stable? Would they remain secure? Would they remain free from capture? And was the governance system overseeing them that was being proposed something that would ensure that that continued into the future? And we believed that the answer was yes. So we supported the transition, and I would say that thus far the implementation is certainly well underway within ICANN, within the various communities. It's important to understand the IANA transition was not only about ICANN, but there are a lot of communities affected by this transition, and that implementation is well underway and in place. So I think that the thing to focus on going forward is to ensure that the systems that were put in place to bring about accountability, to ensure that these functions continue to be managed in a way that is in the global internet's best interests, I think that's where all of our focus should be. So as the Trump administration looks into this and the interactions with ICANN going forward, I think it should be part of the global community in ensuring that this important resource continues to be managed in the public interest. So I think less discussion about rolling back things that are already well underway and in place, and more focus on making sure that the principles of the transition are upheld going forward.
Yeah, my answer is no, it can't be undone. And it's largely because it's not a policy decision.
Right.
As you know, the way we've been talking about things like internet freedom and so forth, it was a contract, and the contract has now has lapsed, and you can't make somebody sign a contract. So I have no doubt but that the particular issue that was in controversy as of October 1st of last year will not be undone. Now, having said that, one of the things which I've been very passionate about, and I had to testify on this issue a couple of times before Congress, is that just because it can't be undone doesn't mean that there isn't a potential problem that needs addressing. Sally has addressed part of it, an important part of it. In addition, the fact that the IANA transition has taken place, that ICANN no longer has a special relationship with the U.S. government, does not mean that the rest of the world has now gone away and is happy about these issues. The position of many other governments remains unchanged. That is, they want to play a much stronger, more active, more, why even say, dictatorial role with regard to the way in which the Internet is government writ large. We, the U.S., whether it's government, private sector, NGOs, and others, as well as the rest of the world who believes in the same way, need to be very vigilant. They're going to places like the U.N., there are issues at the ITU, there are issues in many intergovernmental bodies to try to create a regime that would be much more proscriptive as a matter of international law. The Chinese have recently, earlier this year, been explicit on this issue. President Putin has been explicit in the past on this issue. So I take them all at their word that they are still very seized with this issue.
If I could just echo to that, you know, sir, you raised the question of what should the Trump administration do on internet freedom specifically, but I would extend, you know, the comments on internet freedom to this model of internet governance that the United States and its allies have been promoting for a very long time. And I think it's, as David said, there could be a tendency for people to think that, you know, we did the transition and now we can pack up our tents and it's over. But I think I think if you've heard anything today, that the pressures on the internet continue, the pressures on this model, this way of working continue. And, you know, the tendency to respond with government-directed action, whether it's shutting down, whether it's rights, whether it's regulation, this kind of knee-jerk reaction to issues is not going away simply because we completed this transition. So I think we would certainly look to this administration to continue the U.S. support and leadership for this model going forward.
Well, time is short, as we have basically concluded today. Obviously, these issues that we've discussed will continue. There's a lot to be decided. There's a lot to continue in terms of research and in other areas. We here at Brookings intend to be part of that conversation, as do all of these wonderful, wonderful people today. Sally Wentworth, David Gross, Jackie. Thank you.